Welcome to the podcast that is the very definition of ass to ass. It's Film Book Cast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me as always is a man who is still trying to perfect his part in Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake and falling deep into a psychological torment while he does it.
Mike Tricchio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
My progression as a professional ballet dancer, not doing so hot, but I'm working at it.
That is unfortunate. You're not the most graceful ballerina I've ever seen.
No.
But you're working there.
But I'm committed to the role, Mike.
Yes. By the end of it, though, it's going to be a haunting experience that none of us will ever forget.
Yeah.
If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our featured review, and if the Darren Aronofsky movie references didn't give it away at the beginning of the podcast, we are reviewing the new film from director Darren Aronofsky, and that movie is called Mother. Are you excited to dig into Mother, Mike?
Yeah, I think this is going to be a very interesting discussion as we try to figure out what the fuck we watch.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this, too. This movie did not do super well at the box office this weekend. I would not have expected it to after watching the movie. And it's kind of impressive that a major studio actually put it out. And I'll talk about it during the review, but Paramount actually released a statement about Mother in that regard, which I thought was pretty funny. So I'll talk about that a little later on. But it is not the movie that people were expecting, I think. Like, you watch the trailer, and I think it promises a very different movie than what it actually is.
Yeah. Every Aronofsky film is tragically mismarketed, I think.
Although that worked out for, like, Black Swan was a pretty big hit, if I remember correctly.
That's true.
Huge. Actually, The Wrestler was pretty big, and Noah actually made a lot of money at the box
office. Did it really? Yeah, I thought that was terrible, like, did not work.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not really a fan of Noah, but that movie made a lot of money. I think because, like, you know, anytime you make, like, a big religious epic, like, the people who run churches tell their parishioners to go out and see the movie.
That's fair, yeah.
So a lot of the religious groups, like, were all big on Noah. But anyway, yeah, so Mother is the first actual, like, flat-out bomb for Aronofsky since his last most ambitious movie of all time, The Fountain.
Oh, the fountain.
Yes. So we'll talk about Mother in a little while. But first, we got to get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for.
What?
It's time for.
Who?
It's time for.
Film news.
Hi, it's time for.
What?
It's time for.
Who?
It's time for.
Film news. Film news.
All right, Mike, let's get into some film news for Film Bookcast. Now, I was so pissed off about this. not because I'm upset about the news. The news, actually, I'm pretty okay with. But a few weeks ago, we recorded our last episode of Film Bookcast, right? And in that episode, we reported that Colin Trevorrow had left Star Wars Episode IX. That was the big news. And I didn't think there would be any updates to that for a little while. The very next day after we recorded that episode, just like honestly, like minutes before I published the podcast, before it went online, there was breaking news that Episode 9 now has a new director, and it's a pretty familiar name to the Star Wars franchise. J.J. Abrams is back, Mike.
Yes.
He is doing Star Wars Episode 9. The revolving door of Star Wars directors. I said that in the last episode. I said it's become a revolving door of Star Wars directors. It's now literally a revolving door because they're coming back. It's the boomerang of Star Wars directors. He's gone and he returns. J.J. Abrams, director of Star Wars The Force Awakens, will be on hand to direct Star Wars Episode 9. This kind of came as a surprise to me, Mike. I don't know. How did you feel about the announcement of J.J.?
Yeah, I was definitely not expecting that. I know we were kind of talking about speculating hopefully Rian Johnson would come back, which is something that would have made me much more excited. That said, though, I am down for J.J. Abrams to have Episode 9. I really liked Force Awakens. I think I've maybe, upon watching it a couple more times, felt the beats of A New Hope much more now. It's like, you know, I remember at the time I was much more forgiving of that. But, you know, as a year or two or whatever it's been has gone by, I'm a little more upset about it, or, you know, a little harsher towards that feeling.
Yeah, I wouldn't say upset, but it is something that kind of nags at me when I watch the movie.
Yeah.
And that's something that happens with the Star Wars prequels, too. Like, they echo the other ones in certain ways, but kind of, it's weird to praise the prequels over Force Awakens, but I feel like I like the echoes in the prequels more. It kind of feels more organic in those movies.
You shut your whore mouth, Mike.
But with Force, I think Force Awakens is better than all the prequels. But it's just, I think the great thing about Force Awakens, I think it's probably best, its best quality, is that it is so briskly paced, you don't have time to think about anything that's going on. any criticisms that you might have in the with the movie itself, you don't have time to think about it because the movie's already moving on to the next thing. And that's partially a problem with the movie. I wish there was like time where it could take some time to, you know, be quieter, have a little more character moments. But it is such a fun ride while you're watching it. And that's kind of what J.J. Abrams usually delivers. I feel like a Star Trek movie's kind of hit the same beats in that regard. But yeah, this came as a surprise to me. I know Rian Johnson, I believe, was Disney's first choice. I think they asked Rian first to do episode 9 because he's already deep on episode 8. And I believe he wrote a story treatment for 9 when he was originally hired. I don't think he actually wrote the script, but he wrote like the outline of what his story would be. And then when Colin Trevorrow was hired, I believe he kind of rewrote it and kind of moved away from what Rian Johnson wanted to do in episode 9 and started doing his own thing, which, you know, he was the director, so totally fine, whatever. But he's out now, so fuck him. And
so spit on his grave and move on.
Yeah, exactly. So I was hoping that Rian Johnson would come on board, especially because I feel like that would be such a huge vote of confidence for episode 8. I'm already pretty confident episode 8 is going to be great because Rian Johnson's a great director. And behind the scenes word is that Disney is super happy with what he's done with episode 8, which is why I think they probably wanted him for 9. But I think JJ was probably their second choice right after. You know, it's interesting because they, you know, when they first started doing these Star Wars movies, they were hiring these like really bold and young new names left and right. And one by one, they have all fallen.
Yep.
And now they're falling back to the people who have already made Star Wars movies.
they're falling back on the person they know can make a Star Wars movie that will earn literally every dollar on the planet.
Exactly.
So where I'm in, sure, why not at this point? You know?
So yeah, well, I would have preferred Rian Johnson over JJ or some exciting new bold name, even though Disney would have fired them in 6 months. you know, like I think Rian Johnson's a more interesting director, but Abrams is a really solid director, a really good one, and he delivers like really fun stuff. I don't think I've ever like outright disliked one of his movies, the closest probably being Star Trek Into Darkness. But even that, like, it has its moments. It has a lot of fun sequences. And The Force Awakens is dope. It's dope as hell. It's a lot of fun.
It is. Super dope.
Yeah, and, you know, him getting the chance to actually wrap up this trilogy that he started is kind of cool. You know, it's kind of a neat thing. Like, it's kind of coming full circle. So it's a little weird. It's like Abrams, Johnson, Abrams. Like, it's not... it's not like he's been gone forever and then is coming back to finish up what he started. It's like... You know, he sat a movie out and then came back. I think part of the problem with hiring Johnson is that he's so deep on episode 8 right now, and episode 9 pre-production basically has to start like now. And so JJ is now hired, but the movie has been pushed back. It was supposed to come out May 2019. It's now December 2019. That movie's coming out, which I honestly like. Star Wars has kind of staked out that December date as their birthright at this point. Almost like Force Awakens and Rogue One have both opened in December. Episode 8 will open in December. It seems like that's going to be the new Star Wars date, or it should be at least at this point. It's obviously doing really well for them. And before that, traditionally, it always opened in May. But Disney can make a lot more dollars in December when there's no movies in January and February, so people are just going to see Star Wars over and over again.
That's true, yeah.
So it's been working out. But it's weird because now the Han Solo movie is the only one that's supposed to open in May 2018. And it's still there, so, you know, whatever.
But who even knows about that anymore?
Yeah, but what's kind of funny is that Force Awakens was supposed to open May 2015. And as soon as JJ was hired, he pushed it back to December. And now as soon as he was hired for this one, he pushed it back to December. That's his go-to move.
Yeah, he's just a Star Wars purist, right?
He just
got to keep with the tradition now.
Yeah, now the tradition that he started. He's the purist for his own thing. Anyway, so yeah, I think that'll give JJ a little more time, which is good. And it also frees up some space in summer 2019 for other stuff to move in there. For example, John Wick 3 just announced its release date for May 2019.
You're goddamn right.
So fuck yeah, John Wick's in the summer now, baby. Keanu Reeves is coming for you. I think Star Wars moved because John Wick was on his way.
Mm-hmm. They heard about John Wick 3.
They saw Keanu on the corner and it's like, oh man, I heard that guy killed a dude with a fucking pencil, and Star Wars just like bolted.
I was like, we gotta go.
Anyway, so yeah, that's the big Star Wars Episode 9 news. We still have Episode 8 to look forward to, so 9 is a little ways away. And then we have the Han Solo movie in between those as well. So we have plenty of Star Wars for the next for foreseeable future, but Episode 8 almost upon us. It's a couple of months now. And I'm pretty excited. There's still only been the one trailer. Like, there hasn't been any new marketing material. Like, there's been, like, you know, some images here and there, but there hasn't been, like, a new trailer, which I'm kind of surprised about. I feel like at this point there would have been one.
Did that D what's their Disney's like own press event thing? D23, yeah. Did that happen already? That's a spring thing, right?
I believe that already happened. Yeah, and I think they showed a sizzle reel of Star Wars there, but that was never released online or anything.
All right.
So
interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be another trailer at some point pretty soon, but as of right now, we're kind of in the dark on pretty much everything about Episode 8, which is exciting. That's exactly
That's what I want.
Yeah.
Yes.
And even Rian Johnson's being on Twitter and saying, like, you know, people have tweeted at him, like, hey, I don't want any spoilers for Episode 8, and Rian Johnson's like, yeah, then don't watch any of the trailers. Like, you, he's saying, like, you're going to watch it anyway, so maybe just avoid all the marketing materials you can. And like,
yes, join the Unsullied, at least for Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. So that is pretty cool. So let's move on from Star Wars, even though we can never truly move on from Star Wars because it will always exist in our hearts and we'll be watching it every year until we die. We do have some other pretty major film news, Mike, and this is pretty cool. As you know, there's a new Halloween movie in the works, Mike, directed by David Gordon Green and written by David Gordon Green and Danny McBride, of all people, which is kind of insane. Blumhouse is producing it. There's a potential possibility for John Carpenter doing the score for it, which would be pretty insane.
That would be the best thing ever.
And now we have some new news surrounding the Halloween movie, some casting news, and this is pretty big. Jamie Lee Curtis will be reprising her role as Laurie Strode in this new Halloween movie.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's still unclear in what capacity she'll be in the movie, but, you know, she was in Halloween 1 and 2, and then she was in Halloween H2O and Halloween Resurrection, and that was the last one she was in 2002. Her character actually dies in Resurrection.
Spoilers, Mike.
But you know what? Michael Myers also dies in, like, six of them, so...
And I'm pretty sure every one of them, yeah.
But it's interesting. So this movie, it's been kind of unclear on how they're going to approach it, but they've said they're going to erase most of the Halloween continuity and focus, like, making a direct sequel to the second one or something. So it's possible that they're ignoring H2O and Resurrection and just doing their own thing with this new version of Laurie Strode, which, whatever, I don't care.
At this point, it's a Halloween movie. Like,
it's a Halloween movie. Get Michael Myers in there, and now that Jamie Lee Curtis is back, like, cool, whatever, I'm down. I can see you taking on, like, the role of Donald Sutherland in the original, like the guy.
Oh, that would be fucking awesome.
Yeah, like the kind of person.
Donald Pleasance.
Yes, Donald Pleasance. Who? Oh, yeah, sorry. That's I'm sorry about that. Sincerest apologies. but yeah, he played Dr. Sam Loomis, and I could feel I could see Laurie Strode kind of taking on that role of, like, the person who knows all about Michael Myers and is trying to protect whatever kids he's stalking in this movie. Like, I think that could be a pretty cool way to do it. So I'm excited about that. It's supposed to hit next year, and it seems to have a lot going for it. So there's a lot of reasons to be excited. And Blumhouse, was the guy, Jason Blum, who's producing the movie, was saying, like, you know, people are asking about it because it's supposed to hit next year, which is pretty soon. Like, it's supposed to hit October 2018, and they haven't started filming or anything. But it's also a Blumhouse, so it'll be a pretty low budget production, and like it'll
they'll film it in 2 weeks, and nobody will even know.
But he was even saying like something along the lines of like, I'll chop off my left arm if it doesn't make this release date. So he seems pretty adamant that it's going to be hitting in October 2018. So hopefully it'll be good. I'm pretty optimistic about this one. I feel like I like David Gordon Green a lot. Like, he's got a pretty hit or miss career, but when he hits, it's usually pretty good. And Danny McBride writing it is just the most insane thing of all time.
So I'm in it just for that.
Yeah,
just to see what happens.
Hopefully he acts in it too. I want him to be in the movie.
He'll be Michael Myers.
He should be Michael Myers. I want. I saw somebody like posing the question. I don't know if you know this, Mike, but the original Halloween mask was like an old William Shatner mask that they painted white.
Like, it was a Captain Kirk mask, right?
And so somebody was saying, like, what if they took like a Chris Pine mask and used that for the new Halloween?
That would be amazing. Yes.
I would love that so much. That probably won't be the case, but but you never know. So anyway, yeah, that's the Halloween news. And then I have one other big piece of news. The Emmys were on last night. Now, Mike, you, I'm assuming, did not watch the Emmys.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, I did. Yeah, usually with these award shows, I usually watch all of them because I like them. You know, I like these empty, meaningless award shows. Just cause I like I like seeing shows that I like get, you know, arts that I enjoy getting recognized and, you know, stuff that I like. You know, I like seeing all these, like, famous people in a room together, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun. What's weird, though, is a paradox. I really hate the red carpet part of the
Well, yeah, that's the least interesting part.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just bullshit. But, you know, the actual award ceremonies, like, you know, seeing, you know, whatever comedy bits or whatever I'm usually into. And, like, I like seeing things that I enjoy getting nominated or winning stuff. And I don't really care who wins. I just like seeing things. But anyway, they aired last night on CBS and hosted by Stephen Colbert. And I love Colbert. You know, I'm a big Colbert fan from way back. The Colbert Report? That was, like, required viewing for me. For a long time. Like, I was really into that show for a really long time. And I think he's kind of settled into a groove and found his voice in The Late Show. I was watching, like, every episode of The Late Show when he first started. And I liked it, but, you know, it wasn't really the same. But I haven't really watched The Late Show regularly in a long time because I am not awake that late anymore. so it's just like I'll watch clips here and there on YouTube and stuff like that. But I did feel like his hosting stint here was mostly pretty weak. And there's one cameo appearance that sort of like cast a pall over the entire evening. Did you hear about this at all, Mike?
Is it Sean Spicer? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it is Sean Spicer. Former White House press secretary Sean Spicer made a cameo appearance in Stephen Colbert's monologue, kind of lampooning Melissa McCarthy's impression of him. And it just felt gross, man. It was crass. It was very just clearly him trying to rehabilitate his image without actually admitting that he did anything wrong, you know?
Yeah, that he was complicit in helping a Nazi be in the White House.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like any of that
and
stuff.
Lying on his behalf and all that. And, you know, it felt like you could watch the normalization in real time. Like it was
it was happening right before your eyes.
It was kind of incredibly upsetting. And it stands in kind of blatant opposition to the rest of the night, which was so anti-Trump that Alec Baldwin won Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy for Saturday Night Live, which is an award he shouldn't be eligible for because he's not a cast member of that show.
Yeah, that's amazing.
You know, and even like other bits throughout the night, there was a reunion of the movie 9 to 5 for some reason. It's a TV award show, but they reunited the movie 9 to 5. Like it was like a big thing. It was an advertised thing. It was like Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda, and Dolly Parton. And you know, Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda are on the show Grace and Frankie, so it makes sense that they're there. And like, you just throw Dolly Parton in there because they were all in the movie 9 to 5. But it's like, oh, we're gonna celebrate the best of TV by reuniting this movie from 37 years ago.
Yeah, what? Okay,
it's a little weird. But they had a pretty like a really solid anti-Trump speech. Although interestingly, Dolly Parton didn't say anything in there. I assume like a lot of her base is also Trump supporters, but you know, and so there's a lot of that. And Donald Glover won an award, a couple of awards actually. He won Best Directing for Atlanta and Best Actor for Atlanta, which was awesome to see. Just as a huge fan of Community and a huge fan of Atlanta, I was like, "Fuck yes, Donald Glover!" But even he in his speech like thanked Donald Trump because he figured he won because people were so anti-Trump at that point that they wanted to support an artist of color.
That's awesome.
And even the award of the night, the best drama series, went to The Handmaid's Tale, which is a political allegory show that people have compared to the Trump administration. So there's a lot of like anti-Trump sentiment going on. And you have this like just shoehorned in Sean Spicer cameo that's just there for like a cheap joke. And it's like, it's so weird. It was really bizarre. And it kind of like, I don't know, kind of cast the entire night in this poor light. Like, it's all anybody could talk about the next day. It was, if you saw on Twitter, like, that's all people were talking about. And it was, you know, kind of upsetting. But the actual awards were pretty good. Like, the actual, like, what actually went out to people, you know, I thought were mostly pretty all deserving. I don't watch The Handmaid's Tale. I want to, but it's on Hulu. And
so, RIP that.
That's the thing. I already pay for Netflix, Amazon, and I have HBO Go. And it's like, I'm not going to, If I get Hulu, I'm only going to watch The Handmaid's Tale. You know, it's the only show.
Yeah.
And maybe Difficult People, because I've heard that's awesome and that's supposed to be a really funny show with Billy Eichner. But otherwise, it just doesn't seem worth it right now. But I really do want to watch The Handmaid's Tale, so maybe when it hits DVD, I'll rent it or something.
There you go.
But that is kind of huge because it's the first ever streaming show to win one of the best show awards at the Emmys.
Really?
Yeah. And that's on Hulu. Like you would have thought Netflix or Amazon would have absolutely gotten there first, right?
I'm going to put a tinfoil hat on and say that because Hulu is owned by the cable companies, it was the first one to win the Emmy.
Oh, snap. I mean, to be fair, there's been several nominated over the past few years. I think Netflix even had 3 shows in the Best Drama Series category nominated this year. It was Stranger Things, The Crown, and something else. I'm blanking on whatever it was, but I'm positive Netflix had a 3rd show in there.
Yeah.
And Westworld was nominated from HBO, and Transparent was nominated from Amazon in the comedy series. And they, like, a lot of these shows have won other awards in the past. Like Jeffrey Tambor has won for Transparent a few times, and
right.
You know, there's been other ones here and there. And Master of None won an award last night, which was amazing. That was probably the highlight of the night for me. Was Master of None won for writing, and it was for the Thanksgiving episode, which was like one of the best episodes of TV I watched all year. And it was written by Aziz Ansari and Lena Waithe. And Aziz Ansari just kind of let Lena Waithe do the entire speech. And she's like a gay black woman, and the episode's about her experience. And it's a really powerful episode of TV, and her speech was fantastic. And Veep won Best Comedy this year, by the way, for the 3rd year in a row. And I really thought Atlanta was going to break Veep's streak this year.
Yeah.
That's what I figured. But Veep did win, and it was still a good season of Veep. It wasn't, I think it was kind of a bit, like, not quite as good as some of the seasons past, but it was still, you know, a fun season of Veep. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus won Best Actress again, making her the person who has won the most Emmys for playing the same character. This is the sixth straight year in a row.
Holy shit.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus has won Best Actress for Veep, which means there's only been six seasons of Veep.
Yeah. That's crazy.
And Veep is ending next year. It's seventh season's going to be its last. So I really just I just want her to win the seventh one.
If she just sweeps also for her, every season.
That would be incredible. She also won an Emmy for Seinfeld and an Emmy for A New Adventures of Ultra Scene. So she has like
that's
just
too many.
Yeah, just too many. Like, she uses them as doorstops or something. So yeah, that was pretty cool. And Elizabeth Moss also won for The Handmaid's Tale. And Elizabeth Moss gave one of the best performances of all time on any TV show on Mad Men and was snubbed every single year. She was nominated, I'm pretty sure, every year, which was eight Emmys that she could have won for Mad Men and lost every single time. And that's a damn shame. So I'm really happy that she won for The Handmaid's Tale, even though I don't watch it. But yeah, and that's kind of nice because in Mad Men, it was such a weird case because that show was nominated every year. It won Best Drama Series for the first 4 years it was on. And then, like, it was always nominated in acting categories, and it had, I think, like, the most well-acted every actor on that show was incredible. It was the best acting you could watch on TV for the entire period that Mad Men was on. Up until the final season, it had never won a single acting award. And then
Breaking Bad was always there.
Yeah, that's true. Breaking Bad always took it. And Bryan Cranston absolutely deserved those awards. John Hamm finally won during the last season of Mad Men, but it finally broke the streak. That was like, there was like 21 acting awards that Mad Men could have won, I think, out of those nominations.
Wow.
And like, it just didn't win any of them. It was kind of insane. But anyway, yeah, that was the Emmys last night. It was as a ceremony. Like, there was a couple of funny bits. Stephen Colbert did a Westworld bit that was actually pretty funny. Like, it's him out on the stage, and he's talking about how he's hosting the Emmys, and he's like, "Yes, I am the host." And he starts talking about how he's a host and being a host, and then he starts like short circuiting, and then
amazing.
And then he like cuts back, and it's like a pre-recorded bit with Jeffrey Wright interrogating him about being an Emmy host, and it's pretty good. Otherwise, like, you know, some funny bits here and there. Seth Meyers had pretty funny bits, and otherwise, you know, whatever. The Sean Spicer thing really just like took the entire thing down.
It really ruined the whole thing.
Yeah, but the awards went to deserving winners, and see what happens next year. You know, I'm really interested to see what happens next, because this year was kind of an interesting case because Game of Thrones was out of the running, right?
Right.
So Game of Thrones won the last 2 years in a row, and if Game of Thrones was nominated this year, it would have won. Like.
Yeah.
Hands down. But, you know, its season aired too late to be eligible for the season of the Emmys. So this past season of Game of Thrones will be eligible for next year's Emmys. And so this time, Handmaid still got to win. But next year, it's probably going to be Game of Thrones again, I would imagine.
I would assume, yeah.
Unless Twin Peaks goes for the drama category, which, you know, it probably... I would rather Twin Peaks go for the limited series category, because that is the one where I think it could potentially win.
Yeah. That's true, yeah.
And it deserves to win everything, as far as I'm concerned. Actually, the limited series category went to Big Little Lies this year, and that swept a whole bunch of awards, too, which is another show I did not end up watching, and I've heard awesome things about, which is, like, I remember seeing trailers for it and thinking, like, oh, it's from the director of Dallas Buyers Club. I probably won't like it. And but then it turned, like, every review I've heard has been, like, glowing about it, so I should check it out at some point. And Laura Dern won an Emmy for that also, and I was happy about that because I love Laura Dern.
Nice.
But anyway, yeah. So that about wraps up my thoughts about the Emmys. You didn't watch it, so I'm assuming you have no thoughts.
Agree.
Fair enough. And then I do have one last bit of film news, Mike. We have to end our film news on sad news because that is the the tradition for this podcast at this point.
Yeah, apparently.
One of my favorite actors of all time died just this past weekend, Harry Dean Stanton. One of the greats. I mean, Roger Ebert people have been sharing this quote a lot, that Roger Ebert once wrote that no movie featuring Harry Dean Stanton in a supporting role can be altogether bad. And he's right. Like, damn it, he is.
Yeah.
He's correct.
Yeah.
You know, Harry Dean Stanton was just a guy who was just in, like, everything, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was always amazing, like, whenever you see him.
He's been playing the grumpy man with a cigarette for the last 45 years.
In his real life and also in movies, you know, and like, whenever I think of Harry Dean Stanton, I usually jump straight to Alien, and I always think of him as like starting off in that movie, but I was like looking through his filmography and he was in like 20 years of movies before that. Like,
holy shit.
Yeah. Like Alien was in 1979, but you know, before Alien, he was in Cool Hand Luke. He was in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. He was in The Godfather Part 2. You know, after that, I mean, he was in Escape from New York. He was in Christine, Private Benjamin, Pretty in Pink, Repo Man, which is a phenomenal movie. If you've ever seen Repo Man, that's a really great movie from, like, punk rock filmmaker Alex Cox. It's really solid. Yeah. And Wild at Heart, all his work with David Lynch is really good. And Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, The Green Mile. He even shows up briefly in freaking Avengers. He's in that movie.
Yeah,
when the Hulk crash lands from the sky into, like, this building that Harry stands as a security guard of, and he has, like, a pretty funny line about Mark Ruffalo's pants, and it's, you know, and it's just that it's the kind of role where it's like, holy shit, that's Harry Dean Stanton. Like, that could have been anybody. That could have just been, like, a random extra or whatever. And it's like, no, they went the extra mile. They got fucking Harry Dean Stanton.
They got Harry Dean Stanton
in that role. And it's actually I didn't know about this until this morning, actually, but there's a deleted scene featuring Harry Dean Stanton in the Avengers.
Really?
Kind of giving a pep talk to Mark Ruffalo before going into the Battle of New York. And I was watching it. I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. I wish this was in the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, and all that only just scratches the surface. We were talking about him somewhat recently for The Complete Works. He was in that movie that Nicolas Cage directed, Sonny. And
yeah.
I remember in that review, we were saying, like, you know, almost everybody in this movie is not very good. But Harry Dean Stanton's given a really good performance.
Yep. Yeah. And that's all. It feels like that's true of every film he was in. Yeah. I mean, you know, some of them are everyone's being great. But even when all the other actors are doing a really bad job and the movie's kind of shitty, we still got Harry Dean Stanton as a bright ray of hope.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And all that really just stretched the surface. The dude just, like, never stopped working up until he died. Like, he was 91 years old when he died, which is insane. Still doing amazing work. Like, he was on this past season of Twin Peaks. You know, he was incredible on this past season of Twin Peaks, where he appeared several times, reprising his role from Fire Walk with Me. And I'm so glad that we got that, you know, like that. Like, there's so many, like, moments of beauty with Harry Dean Stanton's character in this past season. Like, just the scene of him, like, in the trailer park. We just watch him perform an acoustic version of a song for like 2 minutes. Like, it's just,
yeah,
it's, you yeah. watch that and, like, luxuriate in it. And there's so much good stuff with Harry Dean Stanton's character. And in fact, he is the star of a movie that's being released next week. Called Lucky, which is about a 90-year-old chain-smoking atheist encountering characters on a spiritual journey. And
so he filmed his autobiography?
Yeah, that's the character is, like, heavily modeled on Harry Dean Stanton himself. And I'm really interested to check this out. The movie also features David Lynch in an acting role.
Wow.
So I'm definitely going to be on the lookout for that, because that sounds pretty insane. And yeah, so I just wanted to, it's like, RIP Harry Dean Stanton. He's one of my absolute favorites. And somebody pointed out that you know, the alien crew... is the actors who played the crew in Alien are now dying in the order that they died in Alien.
Oh, god damn it.
First was John Hurt, now Harry Dean Stanton. Both this year, which is kind of insane. So, yeah, look out, Tom Skerritt, because that's...
yeah, that's look good. Out.
But anyway, yeah, so once again, RIP Harry Dean Stanton. Mike, do you have anything else to add, or should we move on?
No, I think we've said everything. He was one of those actors for me that, for a long time, he was just that guy. But recently, you know, because he's in, like we said, fucking every movie.
Right.
but recently he's definitely become a person that I am aware of and an actor that I really admire. And, I think Twin Peaks, like so much of that season, and we just spent 2 hours talking about it on our last episode, was such a beautiful farewell to so many things.
Yeah.
And that's going to be Harry Dean Stanton's farewell, I think.
Yeah, the first thing I thought of when he died was the acoustic guitar song in Twin Peaks when he sang that. Like, that was, you know, just, it's really like he's 90 years old and he's just, you know, strumming away on this acoustic guitar, like, singing.
Yeah.
You know, and actually Macon Amick, who played Shelley on Twin Peaks, tweeted, like, a behind the scenes video of her, like, on a bus with Harry Dean Stanton, like, just driving, and, like, it's just, he's just, like, shooting the shit and talking and singing, and it's, like, really, it's really cool to see. But anyway, yeah, so that's Harry Dean Stanton, RIP. Mike, we gotta move on. Let's go into our discussions.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions on Film Bookcast. Now, Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
Today, I have a flurry of things to briefly mention.
Okay.
So this weekend, Mike, we hung out. We had lots of shenanigans. And in between the shenanigans, we watched a lot of shit.
Yes, so you're just going to talk about all the things that we watched while we were hanging out in
yeah,
at my house
pretty
this weekend.
Much.
Got it.
I didn't have a whole lot of time to watch anything else, so our... my 80s Palooza list is on pause for this episode.
Fair.
And the best thing I think we watched was Oh Hello, Live on Broadway, I believe is the full title. Full title. This is John Mulaney and Nick Kroll doing their two old Jews from the Upper West Side of Manhattan bit from Live on Broadway. I don't remember the characters' names, but
George St. Geekland and Gil Faison.
Gil Faison, that was it. And it's the best thing of comedy ever, I think. Such a, you know, kind of silly meta commentary on live theater and comedy as a genre in the best kind of bizarre surrealist way that John Mulaney and Nick Kroll can do.
Yep.
While simultaneously doing just Jewy New York jokes, which is hilarious.
Yeah, it's so New York, it's actually kind of insane. Like, there's specific references. And I think it's kind of the brilliance of the bit is that everything is so, like, hyper-specific anytime they refer to anything. That it's such an intricately written show, but also, like, kind of loosely improvised, and it's pretty great.
It's crazy. And you got the experience of having seen it live, right?
I did. I saw it live in January. I think it ended in January or February. So I kind of got in right under the wire. But, yeah, it was such an incredible show to see. Like, I had never seen John Mulaney or Nick Kroll live. And I'm a big fan of John Mulaney in particular. I think he's, like, one of the best comedians working today.
Yeah.
And so I was just really excited about this. And, you know, I was pumped for this show, and it delivered on every front. Like, I was, like, in stitches the entire time. And one of the best things about it, there's this guy behind me who just aggressively did not get it.
At
all. And walked out like a half hour in.
I'm so jealous you got to have that experience. That sounds like the best thing ever.
Yeah, and you know, every show had like a different special guest. And in the Netflix version, it's Steve Martin, which is incredible. And in my version, it was Tony Danza. And that was cool. I didn't me and my brother were like brainstorming because we both saw the show together, and we were like brainstorming like who could it be like that's going to be, you know, guesting on the show tonight. And I was telling him like, you know, I know there was one with like Bill Hader. I know there's one with like Seth Meyers, and you know, so I figured there. I was like kind of brainstorming like New York comedians,
right?
And then it was like Tony Danza, who was not on the names that I brainstormed earlier on the show, but it ended up being hilarious. It was really funny. And like I remember, like as when Tony Danza showed up, I was like, oh cool, Tony Danza. But like I was a little disappointed because I don't really know that much about Tony Danza other than like he was on Who's the Boss, which I've seen a few episodes of here and there. But then once he was on stage and like he was just really funny, and they ended up talking about an episode of The Love Boat that he guest starred on, just for like 10 straight minutes. Like it was this went on a tangent about it because it was such a weird description of the episode. It was really intense, and they have like clips of the different guests. They don't have like the full bits, but they have like you know, select clips of the guests from the different shows on YouTube and stuff, which you can check out.
Okay, so you can watch the full special is up on Netflix. One of the other things we watched was about half of the first season of The Good Place.
Yes,
which is a show you watch
forever.
You have, I think you used it as a discussion while it was on TV.
Yes.
I think,
yeah, I did.
Kristen Bell, Ted Danson, I didn't know what to expect other than I knew it was about Kristen Bell's character dies and goes to the good place or heaven or whatever you want to call it. I was not expecting a hard turn into just weird, surrealist sitcom comedy stuff happening. Not even sitcoms, really.
Right.
But created by the person that created Parks and Rec, I believe,
yes,
right?
Michael Schur.
Michael Schur. It has a very community feel to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I
think it's just the weird kind of like just shy. I mean, Community, it's winking to the camera, but The Good Place is kind of just shy of that. It's kind of just hyperbolic. Everything's exaggerated, silly. Everything is. Every episode ends on the most insane cliffhangers.
Yep.
And it's a lot of fun, and I'm definitely going to finish season one of that. Season two, I think, just comes back now.
I think this week.
Next week?
This week, I think it comes back. Wednesday or Thursday.
So airing on NBC for season two. Season one's up on Netflix. One of the other movies we watched, Everybody Wants Some, which is Richard Linklater's spiritual successor, sequel to Dazed and Confused. I know it's another movie you've talked about on the podcast.
I believe I did, when it came out.
Yeah. I had a lot of fun with it. I thought it was really funny in the moment. Thinking back on it, some of the jokes might not age a whole. Like, I know it's like supposed to be set in the 80s and it's dumb college frat bro kind of humor stuff.
Yeah.
But it still feels a little weird when I think about like just, oh, it's jokes about like them trying to hook up with chicks. But that's still, it was fine, I guess.
I mean, I could see that, but I don't know. I feel like it just fits the movie. It fits the movie so well, I feel like.
Yeah, it does fit the setting. Yeah, and like everything that those characters wouldn't be doing that stuff. And it's a lot of fun, just silly college movie kind of thing. If you like Dazed and Confused, you're going to like Everybody Wants Some.
Pretty much.
And then the other thing that I want to bring up, Mike, it finally happened. You finally got me to fucking watch MacGruber.
I did.
I got freaking out here. I killed them. I'm so fucking stupid. I don't know what I'm doing, and everybody hates me.
Look, I will suck your dick. I will suck your fucking dick. I will do it. Just join my team. I'll suck your dick. You can fuck me or get fucked by me. You can watch me fuck something. Just point at something in the room and I'll fuck it for you. Come on, just tell me what you want me to fuck.
Jesus Christ, MacGruber.
Just tell me what you want me to fuck.
At this point, it was like past midnight and we were both hammered, but we did.
Yes. Well, we watched it. I fell asleep for a little bit. But that's because we had been drinking for about 7 hours by then.
Yeah. Way more
actually,
than 7 hours.
Way more than seven. We started at...
Yeah, it was like 13 hours.
Yeah. I was trying to make us sound better than we actually are, Mike.
We are the worst. It's okay.
Yeah, MacGruber, an SNL movie, starring Will Forte, Kristen Wiig, Ryan Phillippe, Powers Booth.
Yeah, in his best role, R.I.P.
R.I.P., yeah. It's just silliness. If you've seen the MacGruber skits, you get the movie, basically.
That's kind of what I love. It's so much more than the skits, though, I feel
it
like.
It really is.
Like, the skits are a parody of MacGyver, and the movie, I feel like, is just a parody of, like, every 80s action movie.
Yeah,
and
it is
a
just
little bit of MacGyver.
Yeah. It is just a lampoon of the 80s action genre.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun and silliness.
Yes. You know, not to mention Val Kilmer, by the way, who is a phenomenal.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Fucking Val Kilmer. I forgot about him. Which is the perfect casting of a spoof of 80s action movies.
Yes.
Villain. Like Val Kilmer. Perfect.
Yep.
So those are my discussions, Mike.
All right. Fair enough. KFBR 392. Am I right?
Hope you've seen MacGruber, listeners.
Yep, fair enough. All right, so Mike, that is your discussions for the weekend. I did want to mention one movie that I did see, and this was last week. I went to go see Stephen King's It, the new adaptation of Stephen King's novel, which has just been a box office phenomenon.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, this movie has made, I think it made $130 million its opening weekend. And it made another $60 million this past weekend. It's doing really, really well, especially for a horror. Like, horror tends to do pretty well, but this is, like, a genuine, bona fide, like, blockbuster hit, and that's something that horror doesn't have that much of. And this is directed by Andy Muschietti, who made Mama a couple years back with Jessica Chastain. Did you ever see Mama, Mike?
I did not.
Okay, that's a horror movie that I remember digging at the time. I remember, like, actually liking it quite a bit, but I don't remember too much about it, other than that Jessica Chastain played a punk rocker. In the movie, and I remember thinking that was cool. Like, that was just a cool, like, character bit for her.
Yeah.
And she looks cool in the movie. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. It's less of an exercise in psychological terror that I think the novel kind of is more of. And it's more of just a fun haunted house romp than anything else. Like, I think it's just a lot of fun to watch. And I have a very little familiarity with the story. But from my perspective, the movie pretty much achieves what it sets out to do, and it has a lot of fun doing it. I think this is it for people who love Stranger Things. That's my...
Yeah, it's another entry... I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but from what I've been told, it's another entry into the genre of four children on bicycles.
Yes.
Which, like, sure, I'm down. Yeah. I'm into those movies.
I was going to say, it's kind of ironic, because, I mean, Stranger Things takes a lot of its cues from Stephen King, specifically It.
Yeah.
So it's like this It feels like it's influenced by Stranger Things, which is, like, a weird, like, circular thing going around there. But I do think this is a better thing than Stranger Things, if that helps. I wasn't the biggest Stranger Things guy, and I think part of it is that I only have to watch 2 hours of this as opposed to eight, which helps like condense the story down a little bit. And all the kids do really gel well together. And also, they're allowed to curse a lot, which is probably my favorite thing about this. The kids, like, swear like sailors throughout this movie. And I think it helps, it makes it feel more like the 80s movies with kids in them. Because those, like, in the Goonies, like, the kids are cursing all the time and all that. Like, the kids are cursing in those movies. And, that's something that has kind of gone away in, you know, mainstream cinema. Like, it's, you don't see a lot of, like, little kid, like, you know, kids cursing, even though, like, kids curse all the time. That's, like, that's when you curse the most. It's, arguably, many of us never grew out of it.
Debatable.
And so some of us still curse all the time, but it was just really endearing to me to see like kids like throwing the F word left and right. I was like, yes, this is something. Maybe that might be why I liked it more than Stranger Things, because Stranger Things doesn't really have the kids cursing.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
But yeah, this is a really entertaining, just crowd pleasing movie that feels like the kind of like almost family oriented horror film that a young kid could watch and like spur an interest in the genre, like Poltergeist. Right. Like I've talked about this a lot on the podcast before, but Poltergeist was that movie for me when I was a kid. Like I saw that when I was 9, and it scared the hell out of me, but I loved it. And it's such like a, it's almost like a kid oriented horror movie. Like it's rated PG, and it's like a big like haunted house, like crazy horror movie that like mm-hmm. ends in a really crazy place. And that spurred me, my interest into going to watch other horror. I think the next horror movie I watched was Halloween. And then it just kind of like
wow.
bounced from there. Like I think I watched Psycho around that same time. So it was like a lot of like things happening all at once. But Poltergeist kind of jumping. You know, is Poltergeist and also Little Shop of Horrors. Which isn't really a horror movie, but it kind of plays upon the horror movie tropes.
Right.
And that's a more family-oriented movie than most horror movies, I would say.
Yeah.
So I feel like if you like Poltergeist, I think you would like It, is basically what I'm saying. I feel like It is kind of in that same vein. So yeah, definitely props to Stephen King's. Like this I didn't really expect much from this movie going in. Like I really didn't think that highly of, like, I'm not that scared of clowns, so I'm just like so I'm seeing it and I'm like, yeah, it's whatever, and the trailers didn't do that much for me. And I knew about the kind of behind the scenes turmoil that Cary Fukunaga was supposed to make the movie.
Right.
And he ended up leaving the project due to creative differences, which and that happened around the same time as like Josh Trank left Star Wars over creative differences. And I was like, man, creative differences are ruining Hollywood, even though it was probably a good thing that Josh Trank left Star Wars. But that was before Fantastic Four came out, so we didn't know.
Yeah, we were so naive back then.
We were but children. and Cary Fukunaga, I think, is a much better director than Josh Trank is. But, you know, Cary Fukunaga did True Detective, Beast of No Nation, and a lot of really good stuff. But even so, I think It, directed by Andy Muschietti, is just a really fun movie. And I will see the sequel when it comes out. I think I'm interested to see how that plays out. Because I know how it's structured in the book. The way the book works is kind of like cuts back and forth between the kids and the adults. Like,
yeah.
It's the same characters as kids and the same characters when they're adults. And the way they did the movie, this entire movie is just as kids. There's no adult scenes, and I feel like chapter two, or whatever it's going to be, they've said it's probably just going to be mostly adults with maybe some flashbacks to the kids, because people love the kids so much from this movie that they
yeah.
they almost feel like they would be like abandoning them. But yeah, and so now there's like fan casting for who's going to play I feel like a lot of like big name actors are going to want to be a part of It too, now that It One was such a huge hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've seen some like thing bandies around. I personally, the girl in the movie, I forgot her name, but A, she's great. B, adult Jessica Chastain would be phenomenal as that character.
Really? That would be really cool.
Yeah, that would actually be great casting. It's because she worked with Andy Muschietti before is why I'm thinking of it. And like it just would be a really cool thing. But yeah, otherwise, also one of the kids from Stranger Things is actually in this movie.
Yeah, I think the main kid in Stranger Things, right? Yeah. Finn Wolfhard or something?
Yes, yeah, Finn Wolfhard, the kid. Yeah, I think he's Mike in Stranger Things, is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in this movie as a totally different kind of kid. And I think he's actually my favorite character in this movie.
Wow.
Which like he's kind of like the fast talking Stephen King jokester, the guy who just like, makes a lot of dirty jokes, all that stuff, and he's like basically the comic relief in the movie, but he's really funny and he has like a really great line towards the end, which is just really good. So It, highly recommend. I think it's pretty much a blast, even if you don't like horror movies. I feel like it's just kind of a fun romp that you can get into. But anyway, yeah. So that about wraps up my thoughts on It, Mike. I feel like you would like It actually. I know you haven't seen it yet, but I feel like, are you planning on seeing it anytime soon?
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely something that I have been meaning to see and definitely want to get to. Hopefully I can find time.
Yeah, that is the toughest part of all. Although now that I have MoviePass, man, I'm just seeing movies left and right.
It's just you're just willy-nilly. Who cares?
Who cares, man? I'll go see anything. Who gives a fuck? yeah, you should get MoviePass. It's the best.
All right.
Save on them dollars. But anyway, yeah. So let's move on, Mike. Let's get out of our discussions and move on into our featured review of Mother.
Hello.
Hello. He's a stranger. We're just gonna let him sleep in our house. Hello?
Hello?
Did you know he had a wife? He has pictures of you in his luggage.
What were you doing in their luggage?
What do they want? God
help you.
All right, that was from the trailer for Mother, the new movie written and directed by Darren Aronofsky. It stars Jennifer Lawrence, Javier Bardem, Ed Harris, Michelle Pfeiffer, Donald Gleason, and Brian Gleason, his brother, among several others. And a couple's relationship is tested when uninvited guests arrive at their home, disrupting their tranquil existence. That is the IMDb plot synopsis for Mother right there. So I'm pretty hit or miss in the work of Aronofsky, Mike. I'll be frank about that. I always admire his ambition. And he always goes all in on whatever he's doing. And occasionally he knocks it out of the park. I really love Requiem for a Dream, Black Swan, which I haven't seen Black Swan since it was in theaters.
Wow.
But there's still one moment from the beginning of that movie that I remember just really fucking with me. I'm curious if you even remember, because it's such a quick thing, but it's like right at the beginning, and I think Natalie Portman walks into her apartment or something, and it's the camera's like scanning the room. And right before it cuts away, in like the center of a frame, you could blink and miss it, but there's a painting and its eyes move briefly.
No, I don't remember ever seeing that, and I just got chills just thinking about it. No.
Yeah, the camera's just panning, and it's panning, and you see like in the corner of the room, like the eyes of a painting like move briefly, and then it cuts away, and it's like, what? What just happened?
Holy shit. No, I need to rewatch that immediately.
And that was from, I haven't seen it since it was in theaters. Like, that was from 7 years ago, and that's still like, that's burned in my brain. But that's the thing. I think Aronofsky's a really interesting filmmaker, and the horror, his horror elements have been so like been a part of a lot of his work, especially Black Swan. And so I was pretty excited for Mother, because I thought, you know, like just about everyone else, that this was Aronofsky doing like a straight up horror movie.
Yeah.
And I think it is still that. I mean, it is a horror film, but it's just not in the way that anybody expected it to be. And that expectation has resulted in the coveted F from CinemaScore.
Yes.
Which is pretty great. There's been people have been writing articles about that. There are only 13 movies to achieve that that F rating on CinemaScore.
Wow.
And some of them are truly terrible movies, like Disaster Movie, like a free parody movie. But others include Killing Them Softly, which had the F rating on CinemaScore, and Steven Soderbergh's Solaris, which is
with
George Clooney. Yeah. And so the F is kind of, like, every once in a while it'll go to a truly terrible movie, but a lot of times it's going to a movie that is it's just not exactly what people signed up for when they walked into the movie. Because the way CinemaScore works, it polls people on the Friday night of a movie's release about what they thought of the movie. And generally, people who are going to see a movie are doing so because they were sold on the trailer. Mm-hmm. And when the movie is not what the trailer promised, a lot of times people are pissed off.
Right.
And that has been the case with Mother, is what it seems like.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be true for this one.
Yeah. So, I mean, Mike, we'll start with you. What were you expecting going into Mother, and what do you feel like you got out of it? And what are your overall thoughts?
Oh, man. Well, I have a – I think I'm a little more on board the Aronofsky train than you, it seems. I mean, not that you don't like him, like you said, but
right.
I love Pi. Love is a strong word for The Fountain. I – enjoy the challenge that is The Fountain.
Yeah, I will say I really admire The Fountain, and I have seen it once, maybe twice. I really got to watch it again. I feel like it's something I need to give another watch, especially after watching Mother. I feel like I want to give The Fountain another shot. But I will say Pi, like, I watched once when I was like 16 and just was not into it.
That's totally fair. Yeah. I think it's interesting to kind of track, you know, a director's kind of philosophy through their work. And I know we talked a lot about in our Alien Covenant reviews to watch kind of Ridley Scott grapple with his relationship to art and creation.
Right.
And that's kind of been in some of his more recent movies. But I think Aronofsky has kind of always been concerned with the theme of, you know, sanity or perception and just kind of humanity and like what it means to be conscious in some weird way.
Sure.
So I was kind of expecting that going into Mother, just because it seemed like a domestic horror movie where it seemed, you know, the trailer seemed like it was going to be husband gaslighting wife or something along those lines. So I was on board for some weird psychological domestic horror. What I instead got was a weird psychological allegory about like art and creation and humanity and all of those things that have been has been present in all of his and throughout Aronofsky's filmography. I think just it was a kind of meditation on those things with horror devices rather than a horror film.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I think it does fall into the realm of psychological horror, but it's just not in the same way that I think we are traditionally led to believe that genre is like. But I will say, I think Mother, you know, reflecting on it, like when we saw the movie together right before you left, and we were both kind of like speechless. We were kind of like both floored. Like we were kind of without words. And, you know, reflecting on it for like the last day or so and reading a little bit about it, I think Mother may be Aronofsky's best movie. I really am just impressed more and more with what Mother was able to do. It is a movie that just like builds and reveals its layers as it does so. And just everything on a technical level, it's just on point. Matthew Libatique, who always does the cinematography for Darren Aronofsky, is just doing great work here. And there's plenty of the camera following a character walking directly from behind shots, which which are always present in Aronofsky's work, which he loves. And there's no score in this movie. There's no like actual like musical score present in the movie. And I think that kind of contributes to the like uneasiness that you feel as the movie goes on.
Yeah, the sound editing and mixing for this film is top notch, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. And Jennifer Lawrence also is really good in it. And I think it's a really different role for her. You know, I think, you know, I've seen in quite a few Jennifer Lawrence movies, and she's normally cast as a really confident characters. You know, like characters who are like kind of outsized and sort of sexualized. And she's pretty meek here. Like she's like kind of like meek or like downtrodden throughout most of the movie.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure it was working at first. Like I wasn't sure if I was like really that into her performance, but the more the movie goes on, just the more it worked for me and the more it kind of all snaps into place. And I think it works a lot more. This movie kind of subscribes to like a similar dream logic that exists in David Lynch's work. And, you know, I think that might just be because Twin Peaks is fresh in my mind because it just finished. So,
and we'll always be there no matter what you think.
That's very much true. But it's just, it's a slow burn for a really long time, right? Like that first hour.
Yeah.
It's slow and you know, there are things happening, but you're like sort of left wondering like, well, to what end is this happening? Right. Like why is this going on? Like it's so slow into what it's doing. And I think it's interesting and it's entertaining. And like, there's dry humor throughout, and there's, you know, like there's intense bits, but that slow burn first hour, you're trying to figure out like what's going on. And then the movie kind of like starts revealing itself to you, slowly at first, and then really quickly, really fast, and then it gets completely insane for a long time.
yeah, we just go full blown off the deep end.
Yeah.
In a really unexpected, well, in the larger scale, unexpected, or maybe in the moment, unexpected. But when you look at the film as a whole, of course, it was going there. I think.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Which is amazing. It's an incredible feat to pull that kind of like storytelling off.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, I thought I had like a pretty solid handle on what the movie was for like its first hour, right? Like I was like pretty like, and I was like, I seriously thought for a while that it was like, okay, it's a horror movie for people with social anxiety, right? Like that was my.
It is.
It's a dramatic interpretation of what it's like to throw a party at your house, right? That's like, and like, if that were all the movie was, I think it would still be like at least okay. Like I was still enjoying it up to that point. But it is really the second half that I think elevates this movie. When it just goes for broke with all out insanity and it just never looks back. And, you know, I, it's not a surprise it's got an F cinema score. As I was watching it, I was like, yep, okay, I could see people not being happy with this. And I'm honestly shocked. I didn't notice any, but I didn't think our theater had any walkouts by the time.
I didn't notice it either, yeah.
Usually when I see something like that in a movie, I will see at least one walk out.
I don't know. Did you notice that as the credits started to roll and the lights came up, the people behind us stood up and said, well, that was fucking dumb.
Did they? And they
Yeah. That's hilarious.
That is always the best. That's always really funny. That always happens. Like, whenever a movie is not like what it was, like they were sold. I think one of my favorites was when I saw The Gray. Which did you ever see The Gray? That's honestly, it's my favorite, one of my favorite Liam Neeson movies, and I think his best of the Liam Neeson action star roles. But it's not really a Liam Neeson action movie, but it was sold as that, right?
Yeah, it was.
It was sold as like Liam Neeson punching wolves for 2 hours. And what you get when you watch the movie is like this really existential drama about a man who's fighting for the will, like who's suicidal, but then, you know, this insane situation brings him back, and he's like fighting to survive. among the elements. And it's not the Liam Neeson action movie it was sold as. And people in my theater were so fucking pissed when we saw The Gray. Like, me and my friend, we were walking like on the escalator going down from the theater, and we could hear the people behind us like just trashing the movie and being like, what the fuck was that? And I was like, I was blown away by The Gray. I was like so impressed with that movie, and I was just, it was just pretty funny. And Mother, same thing. It's you know,
I agree.
Yeah, this will absolutely not be for everybody, to the point where, as mentioned before, Paramount released a statement to the press this weekend, which read, this movie is very audacious and brave. You are talking about a director at the top of his game and an actress at the top of her game. They made a movie that was intended to be bold. Everyone wants original filmmaking, and everyone celebrates Netflix when they tell a story no one else wants to tell. This this is our version. We don't want all movies to be safe, and it's okay if some people don't like it. And I think that's really interesting, because it's kind of what you want a studio to say, right? You want them to back the movie that they made. And the fact that they said, we don't want all movies to be safe, and it's okay if some people don't like it, like, that's kind of ballsy for a studio to say, because they're generally in the market of, like, trying to make crowd-pleasing blockbusters or what have you. You know, trying to make movies that everybody will go see. Like, that's kind of their ideal goal. You know, they want more its. They don't want Mothers.
basically. Yeah, there's this really, like, kind of awkward fine line dance that studios have to do, or not even studios, I guess, really. We you know, put it towards directors and actors, where they make the, you know, we talked about it with Steven Soderbergh in Lucky Logan, or Logan Lucky.
Logan Lucky, yeah.
You know, they make these one for you, one for me kind of thing, where they make these big kind of commercial popcorn movies so they can go make these weird, tiny, bizarre fucking movies. And it's awesome that Paramount is throwing their weight behind Aronofsky on his weird fucking movie.
Absolutely. And the budget for this wasn't huge or anything. It was like $30 million or something. So it's not like it's going to be a huge loss for them regardless. It's just going to be, you know, it'll be a movie. It probably won't make back its budget, but, you know, and the critical reviews have been divisive. It's got like 69 in Rotten Tomatoes, so it's not like it's getting effusive praise either. But right. You know, the people who like it really like it, and the people who dislike it do not. And I do really love the shot of Netflix that they take in that press release, by the way.
Yeah, oh, they slammed them real good there.
Everyone celebrates Netflix when they tell a story that no one else wants to
tell.
Yeah,
when they do something weird.
Oh, it's okay. Everyone loves Okja. But so that was pretty good. And I think part of the best thing about this movie is just the gradual realization of what this movie is. Like, as you're watching it, like, it's kind of insane. Like, I didn't have it fully formed in my head by the time the movie had finished. And I think there's still so much stuff that's open to interpretation. But at least in terms of religious allegory, I think this movie has a lot of really fascinating things to say as it's going on. And I feel like, you know, by the hour mark, you start to, like, kind of get what it's going for. And it starts to reveal itself more to you. And I know you, we'll talk about a lot of that spoilers, but I know you read a lot of stuff, into certain scenes, and, you know, you opened up stuff that I didn't think about. And, it's weird. Like, you went to a Catholic school, right, Mike? You said you did.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like you might have a little bit of knowledge in some of the subjects, because, like, that was part of your school, I'm assuming.
Yeah. We did cover Bible study and all that nonsense.
Yeah. And I went to, you know, I wasn't in Catholic school. I was forced to go to CCD for a number of years. And then, you know, did all the, you know, church stuff, had the confirmation, everything. And then, you know, once I was 13, it stopped. But I know the stories pretty well, like that. Even if I'm not, like, super into them as a religious thing, like, I'm kind of interested in them as a subject, like, as a social thing.
Yeah.
And so there is a lot that this movie has going for it in terms of what it's doing in regards to that. And Aronofsky in particular has just been always, like, a filmmaker who has wrestled with religion in a lot of his work. You know, especially, like, something like Noah, obviously, would be the probably the obvious one, but also The Fountain too.
He's
pretty heavy on that. So we'll talk about that. We should get into spoilers, right? I feel like that's probably the best thing to do. Unless you have more. Do you have things to say before we move on to spoilers?
I want to assign some additional reading to the class, Mike.
Do you? Oh, is that short story you mentioned, right?
Yes. So there's a short story called The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, which is a, like, 35, 40-page short story that came out in, 1892 is when it was published. Okay. And it's notable, it's most notable for being a short story written by a woman in the 1890s about a woman who's deemed to have kind of neurotic hysteria, you know, that kind of gentleman science version of depression before we knew what any of those words meant. Right. And it's the kind of scrawlings, notes of a woman who's been locked in a room in a manor house in the country by her husband because she needs rest to get well over her hysteria. And it's just kind of her descent into madness. And it is powerful in those 35, 40 pages, whatever it might, you know, depending on what version you find is what, you know, what, right. How many pages it is. It's in the public domain, so you can just Google it.
Okay.
And find it, the PDF of it. I walked out of Mother immediately thinking of this movie, of right. The short story.
Yeah, you mentioned it as soon as it ended, yeah.
Yeah, it's just this kind of woman in isolation at the behest of her husband or her, you know, the person who thinks that he knows best, and just what that does to a person, you know, someone who refuses to acknowledge that maybe there's an issue we need to talk about, and what that can do to a person that is in that kind of state. So it's a really interesting comparison. I don't know if there's anything beyond that, the similar themes that are going on.
Well, if you actually go to the movie's Wikipedia page, it does reference, the Yellow Wallpaper.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I think, it may have been an influence on Aronofsky, for sure.
Yeah. It definitely has a lot of that feel and theme to it. I'm also going to assign a novel I read a couple years ago called, Mr. G by Alan Lightman.
Okay.
Which is, Alan Lightman is a theoretical physicist who wrote a story about Mr. G. So basically the whole thing is it's the Genesis story as if God or Mr. G was just experimenting with physics laws and like trying to figure out how to make a universe that can exist on it, like on its own.
Okay.
And just what that would mean and stuff. And it's really interesting, and it kind of ties into that whole creation, you know, artist with his relation to art as it's viewed by his audience, and like that whole thing, which I think is a whole nother allegory for, within Mother, I think,
absolutely,
you know, within the, you know, this context, the director would be the creator, right. Making his movie, right. To the art, you know, and I think that's what is so brilliant about Mother, I think on a lot of levels that there is, you know, and art, the best kinds of art can be viewed by each person totally differently. You know, there's, it's impossible to have a consensus on what something means,
right.
In the best versions of art. So yeah, I just want, those are two books, two things that, this movie made me think of because they kind of tangentially relate.
All right, cool beans. So let's get into spoilers now because I feel we're like approaching spoiler territory, like Terry is talking about that. So let's do that. Let's move on to spoilers from Mother. Starting right now.
Stop it! Both of you! You're spoiling everything!
All right, spoilers for Mother, starting right now. So we should talk a little bit about the plot of this movie, because we haven't really mentioned what the movie's actually about. But basically, Jennifer Lawrence plays a woman who is married to this man, played by Javier Bardem, and they live in this house together, kind of in the middle of nowhere, and Jennifer Lawrence is spending all her time fixing up her house. Javier Bardem is spending all his time trying to write. He's a writer. And then one day, a man played by Ed Harris shows up, and he starts staying at the house with them. And then his wife shows up, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, and things start to escalate from there. Essentially, like more and more people start to show up at the house. Jennifer Lawrence is starting to get more and more agitated and more, I'm blanking on what word I want to use, but like freaked out and like unsettled by what is happening.
Just kind of disrupted. I think.
Like
their routine is thrown off.
Essentially, basically. Yeah. And so essentially the allegory that this movie is going for, and we went a little bit back and forth on this, but, Javier Bardem is essentially playing God in this movie.
Right.
And his character is credited as him with capital H.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's interesting. I assumed it would be poet, but that's, yeah.
Nope. It's him. And, every other character, by the way, and this is the reason that if you watch the movie, the title of the movie is lowercase. It's all lowercase. So every character is lowercase except for him, who is uppercase.
All right. All right. That's a little more obvious than I was expecting.
And Jennifer Lawrence is credited as Mother, and the idea is that she's Mother Earth.
Right.
Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer are playing Adam and Eve allegories, and their two sons are Cain and Abel, the Gleason brothers, Donald and Brian. And it was at that point where Brian killed Donald that I started to realize what was happening in the movie. Like, I was like, oh, okay. Like, it just felt very Cain and Abel. And they even referenced at one point, the character, I think Brian Gleason's character is the one who kills Donald. Brian, like, they mentioned he's disappeared and he's, like, lost in the wilderness.
Right.
It happens to Cain in the Bible. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, I did the sound for a production of a play called Children of Eden. So I actually know quite a bit about the Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel story. and the Noah story, because that's act two of the play. But one of the songs in that musical is called Lost in the Wilderness. I was like, hey.
I got it.
At that point, I was starting to realize what was happening. And so the movie is Aronofsky kind of exploring the concept of God. Religious fanaticism is a big part of it. The impact humankind has had on Earth. While also kind of exploring the struggle of artists and in the process kind of equating himself with God in a weird way.
Yeah.
because he's just super humble.
He's the most humble person you'll ever meet.
And it's not hard to see, like, there's a lot of interpretations you can have with this. And it's not that hard to see the movie as a parable for relationships in his own life that Aronofsky's had, specifically with Rachel Weisz, the acclaimed actress who had a child with him. And supported him during his craziest and most ambitious film that was a failure at the time, The Fountain, which she starred in as well, before they started having trouble and broke up shortly after his critically acclaimed box office hit, which was his comeback, The Wrestler. And that's kind of the arc of this movie is, like, you know, Javier Bardem is struggling to write this thing, and he's not able to do anything, and Jennifer Lawrence is standing by him this whole time. And then once she gets pregnant and things start going well with them, Javier Bardem gets the inspiration and he starts writing again, and that becomes super popular, and that's when their relationship starts to crumble in the movie. And that's kind of what happens with Aronofsky and Rachel Weisz. I would love to watch Rachel Weisz watch Mother. I think it would be really interesting.
She should live stream it like Shia LaBeouf did.
Shia LaBeouf watching his movies. And now, as a weird side note, Darren Aronofsky is now dating Jennifer Lawrence. Which makes the parables to Mother even more so. Like, it's an older man dating Jennifer Lawrence.
Right. Like,
literally Jennifer Lawrence. So it's cool. And, I mean, there's a lot more to it, but I think the point where Kristen Wiig shows up and starts blindly executing people two by two is the point where I may have fallen in love with this movie.
Yeah. I was really enjoying everything, just even on like a technical level, like just the discomfort of kind of like this like tinkling that happens whenever like a glass is moved that kind of lingers and goes on and on. Almost every shot, particularly with every shot with Jennifer Lawrence in it, is framed pretty much in close up, you know, shoulders up for her face, dead center of almost of the frame all the time. And it's just this so much discomfort, given just in a technical technical sense. And then we just take this insane leap into the deep end of, we're just going to do it. And having all of this happen in the confines of a house is incredible. Yeah. Some of these shots, there's in particular like a riots, rioters squaring off against police, like riot gear police with a Molotov cocktail, just in a living room.
It's just like insane.
Fucking wild.
Yeah, and I think part of what I think is makes the movie so effective is it takes a lot of time in that first hour to show you Jennifer Lawrence walking around the house a lot.
Yeah.
And you can see kind of the emptiness of the house. Like it's very wide, it's very open. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, you know, there wasn't any people at that time. It's just the earth, right? As the movie goes on, more and more people show up, and the entire house starts to feel more and more claustrophobic as it goes on, up until the point where it's just like wall-to-wall people like crammed into this small house.
Yeah, I think there's also a really impressive feat where I haven't seen Free Fire, but I remember you talking about it in your discussion saying that it needed like overhead shots to show you the geography and layout of the building that everything is happening in because it was very confusing. Somehow, at least in that first hour to me, the geography, I felt like I knew the layout of where every room was and where everything was placed in this house.
I'm with you on that. I think there's a lot of like one take shots, like long takes that just kind of take you through the house. So I feel like you do get a sense of like everything that's going on within the confines of the house.
So that when things literally explode later, yeah, I kind of felt like I knew where most stuff was until we're jammed, you know, like you said, wall to wall. There's just bodies everywhere. Yes. So I don't know. That's just another impressive thing about this film that I wanted to highlight.
Absolutely. I feel like some people might watch this and see it as like a joyless slog. Like, and I feel like, I feel like they might not be wrong, but I really feel like a lot of it's kind of like gleefully insane almost. And there is like some dry humor throughout, like I said, but I just couldn't help but laugh at the audacity of some of the shit that Aronofsky was going for in this movie. It's not a bad laugh. It's like a holy shit kind of laugh. Like, I can't believe this is happening. Like the aforementioned Kristen Wiig shooting people in the head. There's the incredible escalation into like Children of Men territory. When it's just an entire society of people living like crammed in that small space. And like you were saying, like riots are breaking out left and right. And even just the lead up to that with like people just like bouncing on the sink and all the floods coming in. And, there's so much going on in the last hour of the movie. It's kind of insane to watch. Like, I couldn't believe I was watching it on screen.
Yeah. And I feel like, I just was overwhelmed at points. And I don't mean that in like a bad way. I just feel like I probably missed so much more of what is in these frames, because I assume there's hundreds of extras packed into these rooms. Right. It's probably violated some fire codes, but but it seems like that these things were so incredibly choreographed, and a lot of that moment, that kind of escalation, that climax at the end, that kind of goes into Children of Men territory.
Yeah.
Feels like, I mean, it might be because it reminds me of Children of Men. It kind of feels like one take. obviously there's cuts and stuff in right. there, but a lot of it felt like it's just all happening so fast and choreographed in such a crazy way that I want to see it again. I don't want to experience the whole thing again, but I want to analyze that last 45 minutes and just see what's in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like watching it more, it'll reveal more of the movie to you. I think there's a lot to unpack here, and I think part of the gradual realization of what this movie's going for, like I was saying with the Cain and Abel thing, like once you kind of latch on to the religious aspect of this movie, like more starts to be revealed, and especially as it goes on. So like halfway through the movie, Mother gets pregnant. And she is having the baby, and throughout like the whole sequence with her in the house is running from people left and right, while she's like about to have the baby, and then she finally does, and it's her and Javier Bardem, and then he takes it from her and gives it to the people, and it's very clearly Jesus. Like it's very much be Jesus, and of course the people immediately kill it like they did with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Right, they kill
which fucking one of the most horrific things that is in this movie and that I might have ever seen. Where they just violently snap this baby's neck, like seemingly on accident, but deliberate. I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah, it is. It's really insane. It's made even more right after that they start eating the baby. Which obviously again it's like a communion thing. Like they're eating the body of Christ,
right?
But that is at the point where I would have expected somebody to walk out of the theater. Like I was shocked that nobody did. That is insane. Like, it's just one of those insane things. I can't believe I watched that in a major studio horror movie. That seems like, I could see that happening in a movie. Like, I'm sure I've seen things as fucked up as that in movies, but like that would be like obscure weird shit from like Denmark or whatever that I have to like import from Amazon,
and it's only available on VHS or something.
Exactly. Yeah, it would be like an obscure thing, and to see this in like kind of a major studio release movie is kind of insane. And yeah, Aronofsky is a religious filmmaker that I feel like really has complicated feelings about the religion, that he's like using his movies to kind of work through all of those. And it's kind of like with Martin Scorsese, it's kind of the same thing that he does in his films. He just did that with Silence earlier last year. That's very present in movies like The Fountain and obviously Noah. But I think that fascination with religion is utilized most effectively in this movie. I feel like with The Fountain, I saw it like once or twice and I admire it, but I feel like it's just a mess to me. It's just all over the place. I know people who love The Fountain. Like Fountain's The Fountain is a super popular movie among I wouldn't say super popular, but it is like it's a popular movie among like a certain subset of film geeks who are just really all about what that movie is. I know our friend EJ loves The Fountain, right? He's like a big fan of that movie.
Yeah.
Noah, I am less of a fan of Noah is again a movie that I think is really well staged and like it's admirably ambitious, and like that was such a passion project for him too.
Right.
So I remember he ditched. He was supposed to direct The Wolverine. Darren Aronofsky.
Oh.
Yeah, he was attached to direct The Wolverine before Black Swan came out. And then Black Swan came out and it made a bunch of money. and suddenly he had like some FU money to throw around, and so he's like, I'm not going to do the Wolverine anymore. I'm going to go do this weird passion project from
Nova. Yeah.
And it worked out with that movie. That movie made a lot of money, but you know, I think that kind of gave him the clout to kind of do this weird, smaller horror movie slash religious allegory. And I think the fact that he had Jennifer Lawrence in the lead role kind of helped the studio be like, okay, you have Jennifer Lawrence, people will pay to see her, and that probably won't be enough for this movie to make back its budget. But I'm happy it exists. You know, it's just something that I'm glad is existing. And you know, I feel like people should support weird and ambitious and audacious cinema like this. And
yeah,
there's so many different interpretations of Mother, you know, and what it's all about. I think they all have merit. You know, I feel like every interpretation is like its own kind of thing. And I've seen people like completely ignore the religious aspect of this movie, which I don't know how you can do that, but it's but you can have your own interpretation. It's fine.
Yeah, there's a intricacy and detail that's in this movie that I am impressed and glad that Aronofsky had the chance to make something like this and probably really work through some shit on his own end while writing and directing this film. Because I think it shows. I think the complete turmoil that he might have with his relationship to the biggest questions that humanity has, right, about art and creation and religion and existence and just all that stuff is crammed into this fucking weird psychological horror movie.
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, he puts it all up there on the screen. Like, he puts all of himself into this movie.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating to watch. And, you know, he himself has backed up the religious allegory. Like, he said in an interview that, like, yeah, Bardem is God and Jennifer Lawrence is Earth. And that might make things more clear for some viewers, but I think it's kind of a bummer that he like actually talked about it, you know, and actually said what it was supposed to be. So I feel like part of what I love about David Lynch is he just makes the movies and then just says like, well, I'm done.
Yeah.
My hands this, you guys figured out on your own.
I mean, there's that famous quote, I think, where he says that Eraserhead is my most emotional film, I think. It's like, quote,
spiritual film, I think.
Spiritual film. And the person interviewing him says, do you care to elaborate? And he just says, no.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Like, I wish every director did that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I feel like he could learn from Lynch and just, like, make the work and let us figure it out and debate it on our own. It's a lot more fun that way. And you can have a lot more interpretations. But in any case, I think Mother, probably the most unsettling movie I've seen in a theater this year.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely nothing else like it in theaters right now. There probably won't be for a long time. So if you're a fan of like crazy, insane movies, if you don't feel like you'll be put off by the movie based on this discussion that we've just had, I would definitely recommend going see it because it's not going to be playing near you for very long.
Right. Get it in now while you can.
Get it in there. So any last thoughts about Mother, Mike, before we wrap this up?
No, I just I feel this movie like oddly inspired me to like want to get really back into like film analysis and theory, which I haven't done since college, just that whole the allegory and the relationships that it's trying to figure out I think are really interesting. So I agree, people should see it while they can try and survive.
Yeah, absolutely. Try and survive. Probably the best advice you can give.
Yeah.
For Mother.
TM.
Yeah. So, that is our review of Mother. I liked it. Mike liked it. I really am just kind of floored by it that it exists. So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons and Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, you can check out my work at crookedmarquee.com. I do stuff there, too. Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriccio. If you're listening to this view via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. You can list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast in 2 weeks, where I think we'll be talking Kingsman 2, Mike. I think that's the plan, right? Ooh, yeah.
I'm very in for that.
Yeah, I'm eager to see Kingsman the Golden Circle. I am a big fan of the first one. Matthew Vaughn is a director who hasn't really let me down yet, so excited to get into that. And then you can check out our next Complete Works, where we'll be talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2006's World Trade Center. So thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.